of how to safely vote when you're not able to use what's most readily available, two of them are here to answer your questions. First, news headlines from NPR. Is the Sound of Ideas from 90.3 WCPN IdeaStream. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for joining us. Election day is drawing ever closer. Many of you may have already voted, but for some in Northeast Ohio, voting is not as easy as filling out a ballot in the booth. What if you don't speak English? What if you're blind? This election season, IdeaStream reporters have been researching and answering questions submitted by voters as part of our Listen, Engage, Vote 2020 election coverage. Today, we'll start by hearing some reporting that's come from those questions from two of our IdeaStream colleagues. Reporter Justin Glanville, who joins us by telephone, and multiple media producer Gabriel Kramer, who's 6 feet across from me, socially distanced here in the studio. Guys, thanks both of you for being here.
Sure, Rick.
Thank you.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the way to do that, 216-578-0903 or 866-578-0903. Email us at soi@wcpn.org, or you may tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Justin, I'm going to start with you. You've been reporting on how people with disabilities can vote. What's the law say about accommodating these voters?
Yeah, so federal law is pretty clear on this. It says that, you know, voters with disabilities need to have all the same options for voting as non-disabled voters. So that means states need to have a way for people with disabilities to vote by mail, to vote early, or to vote in person if they want to. So for example, in Ohio, if you're blind or visually impaired or have mobility issues and you want to vote early, or you can't fill out and send a paper ballot by mail, you can apply for an electronic ballot to be emailed to you. And then at home, you can use screen reader technology on your computer to read it out loud and mark your choices.
I know we had questions come in from listeners wondering about how to vote, specifically one if you're blind or visually impaired.
Yeah. We had a question come in asking if it was actually a listener who was asking on behalf of her husband, who's blind, if there's a way for him to come and vote in person. And even though we're expecting record numbers of absentee ballots this year because of the election, we're still expecting that some people are going to want to vote in person, including folks who are blind. So federal law says there needs to be a way for those folks to vote in person, too. And what it says is that each polling place has to have at least one accessible voting machine that essentially makes it possible for people to vote if they can't see very well or if they have other issues. And the machines, I've seen some pictures, they look kind of like an ATM where you sit in front of a small screen that can do things like enlarge the text for you or read an audio version of the ballot to you. And then you make your choices on a keypad that's marked with Braille. And those same machines also help people with other disabilities. So for example, if you don't have use of your hands, you can use a mouthpiece that lets you sip and puff to make your choices on the ballot.
You know, we hear so much about the technological malfunctions we have with other machines. What about if those break? I can't imagine there's a lot of those per polling place.
Right. And yeah, it's definitely something we hear about a lot, right? Like things going a little bit awry during elections. So that is something I asked Ben Hovland about. He's the chairman of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission.
Nothing's perfect, and of course, elections are an underfunded area of our government, but they do go through a series of something called logic and accuracy testing, where you make sure that the equipment is working as it's intended.
So, you know, he told me if voters do encounter a broken machine, they should be persistent and ask what their other options are.
Are there numbers? Do we know how many people take advantage of these from year to year, or is that something that's done county by county? We really don't have a great count.
Yeah, I asked that question of Ben, and he did not, unfortunately, know the answer. The head of the Geauga County Board of Elections, who we're going to hear from in a second, said that every election they do have folks who take advantage of this, but again, he didn't have specific numbers.
Okay. Yeah, I know you mentioned Pete Ziegler there from Geauga County. There are other options besides what we do here in Cuyahoga.
Yeah, so if you don't want to use the machine, if you're just like not into voting by machine, there are other ways to go vote in person if you have disabilities. Every state has their own rules, but here in Ohio, what Pete Ziegler, again, of Geauga County Board of Elections said was that there are a couple other options.
Voters always are allowed to have either someone they bring assist them or a bipartisan team of poll workers assist them if they feel more comfortable with that?
And I should say that the bipartisan team of poll workers is actually two people, and they find one Republican and one Democrat to help you so that those poll workers are not influencing you in any way. Or if they're trying to, the other one can check the person who's trying to influence. And then in terms of bringing someone with you, I found that there were a few exceptions to that in terms of who you're allowed to bring. You're not allowed to bring your employer or an agent of your employer or an agent of your union, if you're in a union. And then this was my favorite exception. You're not allowed to bring a candidate who's actually on the ballot to help you.
Yeah, if you can't wear their shirt, I guess you can't bring the person either. That makes sense.
Right.
You know, we've been hearing about the long lines at the polls. I was passing the Board of Elections here in Cuyahoga County yesterday, and the line was down the street and around the corner and down almost to the inner belt. There are a lot of people who can't stand in those lines or maybe even can't sit in the car that long. How are we helping those folks out?
Yeah, so again, there's no national policy on that. Like, voting places have to kind of handle it their own way. But for example, again, at the Geauga County Board of Elections, Pete Ziegler told me that they have chairs set up next to the line so that people can rest while they're waiting. You can also do something called curbside voting, pretty much just like curbside takeout if you order from a restaurant, where you stay in your car and you call the Board of Elections and a poll worker comes out with all the materials that you need to vote.
Okay, that's a great option for them. We know that a lot of your work has been focused on Woodhill Homes over the past year, special projects you've been doing, the public housing neighborhood on the east side for folks not familiar. Have you had a chance to talk to residents in public housing, in Woodhill Homes specifically, about how they're voting, how they feel about this election?
Yeah, you know, one thing that's been great about being kind of working at Woodhill for the past year and a half is that I've gotten to know some of the folks pretty well. And so I just kind of called up some people that I've met over the past 18 months and asked them how they were feeling about the election, what they wanted, what they care about. And, you know, just for some context, Woodhill is almost entirely Black and low income. And Rick, do you remember a few months ago when Joe Biden got in some trouble for saying things that made it seem like he was taking Black voters'
right,
support
for granted? Yes, I do remember that.
Yeah. Well, I definitely found that to be the case at Woodhill. The first three people I talked to, each one of them had something completely different to say about the election and who they're supporting or not. And the first person I called was Tory Goodman. He works in retail and is on the Residents Advisory Council for the neighborhood. He said he's voting for Biden, but kind of grudgingly, because he saw a big red flag in the fact that it took Barack Obama almost a year to endorse Biden.
That says to me that they do need to get Trump out, so Obama jumped on his bandwagon to help that situation happen. But other than that, this was your president. He was his vice president. You know what I'm saying? I would figure he would be endorsing him from the beginning.
So Tory said that basically for him, that shows a lack of enthusiasm from Obama in Biden's campaign, or maybe that he doesn't think the former vice president can accomplish much if he's elected. Tory also told me he doesn't trust in the process of voting by mail, so he's going to vote in person on Election Day. And for him, going in person that day is like a chance to see how many people are taking the election seriously.
I want to see what happens on Election Day. How many people came out to show their face to be real about this situation? How many of us really, really care about our future?
He said he also expects to see those long lines that you talked about, Rick, and he wants to keep his eye out for any irregularities in how people are treated.
Yeah, that's going to be, I think, one of the stories of Election Day, just to see how long the lines are and what goes on in and around those lines. Okay, so some less than enthusiastic support for Biden there, but you talked to other folks.
Yeah, so the second person I called was Kiana Baker. She's also a retail worker and an entrepreneur. She's in her 30s. And she voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016, but this year she's decided not to vote at all because she's just disillusioned with politics. So let's take a listen.
It seems to me like when you vote, it really don't do too much, because you can vote for a person and they tell you all the stuff that they want to hear, and once they get in there, they like still literally don't do nothing.
She also says that not voting for her, it's not like a passive thing where she's just, you know, apathetic. It's actually an active thing. It's her way of expressing her feeling that some people's voices are not being heard, especially Black voices, but also just people's voices in general.
Our voices don't count, you know what I mean? Not to make it a race thing or anything like that, but like the only way our voice is gonna count is like if we get up as a whole people and say, hey, no, this is not what we want.
So for her, not voting is her way of saying, like, this is not what we want. Neither of the two candidates that are being presented to me this year for president are appealing. And she doesn't believe in supporting what she considers the lesser of two evils.
Kind of odd to make your voice count, though, if you don't use it.
Yeah, I think she's saying she wants other ways. She wants to find other ways of making her voice heard. I think she, for her, like, activism, maybe protesting, like we've seen so much of this year, is more the way she wants to be heard.
Okay, that's two. I know you made a third call.
Yeah, that was with Marquel Hawkins. He's a 30-year-old musician, and he voted for Donald Trump in 2016, and he's supporting him again this year. Let's hear what he has to say about that.
He is taking advantage of being a president, you know, like, saying whatever he wants to say. That's totally awesome to me. Like, I kind of wish that type of, what can I say, language gets said more often.
So Marquel says that he was especially won over to Trump this year after seeing the first presidential debate, which was held in Cleveland, of course, last month. And, you know, so I was a little surprised to hear that. And so I asked Marquel what he'd say to people who call Trump a white supremacist or a racist. And he said he thought that that wasn't fair and that he's seen an evolution in Trump since he took office.
You know, he might not always been there, but to take the time to show up to some events, I mean, you know, that says enough. You can't count on somebody to be everywhere or be involved into everything, you know what I'm saying?
So one example of the type of event that Marquel is talking about is the campaign stop that Trump made in Atlanta last month, where we talked about a program to help Black Americans build credit and wealth. So, you know, a lot of listeners might be surprised to hear what Marquel is saying, but there have been some national polls out. I did some digging online that Trump is doing well this year, at least better than he did last time, among young Black voters in particular. One poll from last month found that Trump's support among Black voters between the ages of 18 and 34 more than doubled this year compared to 2016. He went up from 10% to 21% in support.
Yeah, but I think a lot of older Black voters still remember the president at one of his rallies pointing out the sole Black person there and saying, my African-American. And I bet you hear a lot of that in Woodhill Homes and other areas where people say, I just don't trust him because of the way he treats and talks about people of color.
Yeah, I'm definitely imagining a lot of people yelling at their radios right now.
Yeah, they probably are. Before we let you go, actually, I don't want to let you go. We'll talk about Woodhill Homes a little bit. I wanted to get to Gabe Kramer here. So, Justin, thank you, but stay right there. We don't want to lose you just yet. We wanted to talk about another group of people that are disenfranchised or maybe not thought about as much. Let's bring in Gabriel Kramer, producer here. You did a story, Gabe, talking about people who don't speak English. And I guess in Cuyahoga County, the ballot is in two languages, but we got a lot more than that here.
Right. So earlier this week, I took a trip to the Asian Evergreen Apartments here in Cleveland's Asiatown on Payne Avenue. It's a senior living facility occupied by Asian American residents. I kept a safe social distance and, you know, took some pictures and observed what they had going on. They had a ballot review session. So when I walked in, Mike West from the Cuyahoga County Board of Elections was standing at the front of the room giving directions to about 10 of the residents. And the directions were things like where to take your ballot when you're finished. And one of the things that he talked about, and I want to play a clip here shortly, but he talked about how one of the common mistakes on the ballot when you're filling it out from home is there's a section to put your birth date. And oftentimes people will put today's date instead.
Yeah,
so after he was giving those directions, they had another woman, Susan Liu, from the Cleveland Chinese Senior Citizens Association, translating it to Mandarin. So the fact of the matter is there's a a pretty good portion of our population that can't read English or Spanish, but still wants to participate in voting in this coming election. So they need to find some kind of translation services. So Susan Liu was there to provide some help. So let's play that clip and kind of give people a picture of what happened.
A lot of people get the date of birth incorrect, and they write today's date. It even says, do not write today's date, but still thousands of people get it wrong, and then we have to reach out to them, send them a special form they fill out, and that just causes delays, and nobody wants that. You want this to just go right through without any trouble.
Okay, 选票放入去几个信封入边咧，都有几样嘢要填嘅啊，知道入边有几样嘢要填翻。第一栏就系嗱，主要睇个黄色嗰度啊，系你嘅名、你嘅住址、你嘅出生日期。
It's kind of a case where we got the translation first.
Right, right. So, you know, an interesting thing that they do there because, you know, they do this every year at Asian Evergreen. And as mail-in ballots are still coming in, Susan will be back to provide more interpretation services. But one thing that I thought was pretty cool that she did, I have in my hand, I know, you know, those listening on the radio can't see this, but I have an official general election ballot. It's actually a copy of the ballot. Mm-hmm. But what Susan did was, you know, she imposed Chinese letters onto these sections of the ballot. So where it says to vote completely dark in the oval, she put Chinese letters next to it. So people could use this as a guide. When it says for president and vice president, vote for not more than one pair, she wrote that in Chinese letters so that, you know, these residents could use this as a guide and side by side with their ballot and, you know, fill it out next to each other. But she also sat down individually to help them out.
Do they post like one of those at a polling place for people to check, or do they actually hand them out so you can take two pieces of paper in there and use it as a translation guide?
So Susan brought this to Asian Evergreen to help out these residents. So they don't have this posted at any of the polling places, but voters are allowed to bring interpretation an interpreter, if they'd like, with them to the ballots or to the polls. They're also allowed to bring some kind of documentation, some notes if they'd like, as long as this is, in fact, something they need. So if they don't speak English or speak Spanish or don't read them, this is something that they can bring with them.
And as Justin pointed out, don't bring the candidate with you either.
And, yes, and the same rules same follows, rules, right? You can't bring your employer. You can't bring, you know, someone who's a member of a union.
You mentioned having Mike West there. He knows so much about this process. Did he talk about what this means for voter turnout when people have this opportunity that maybe they didn't have before?
Well, here's the thing. So in 2016, 49% of the voting eligible Asian American population, so those 18 and up, 49% of that population nationwide turned out to vote. And if you compare that to the white population was about 65%. The black population was 59%. So the Asian American population turning out the polls is much lower. And Susan Liu made a comment, and she said that if the ballot was available in more languages, that you would see a greater turnout. Because she said that these senior citizens are engaged. They watch the news. They know what's going on around them. They just can't read the ballot. They just don't understand how to fill it out. So if they can provide some kind of help to bridge the gap, then turnout would be much better.
The number of the population may be small in Kevin or our county or even in Ohio State. But the Asian voters' voice need to be heard. And I think that's very important to do very simple or little things to help them.
So what did the voters have to say about what it means to have that kind of help that Susan's suggesting?
Well, they were very thrilled to have that help. And, you know, Susan suggested that it's very possible a lot of these voters wouldn't actually participate in the election without that kind of help, just simply because they can't read what's on the ballot. And then the other simple things like where to go to vote, how to fill out the ballot, which are simple things that, you know, Mike West helped them out with, and she translated into Mandarin for them. So, you know, they're very proud to be able to participate in this election. She talked about how, you know, a lot of immigrants in the United States come from countries where voting isn't even an option. They can't vote in their countries. They at least have a different kind of voting process where they're not voting for individual people, right? So they moved here. They're part of the country. They're citizens. They want to vote. So they're very proud to be able to do so.
We were talking last week on the program about just how many different languages there are represented in just Cuyahoga County, and the fact that we only have those two ballots, and they're pushing to see, you know, why don't we have Laotian? Why don't we have Urdu? Why don't we have Swahili? You know, is there an effort from Susan or those like her to see us do something different?
Well, Susan certainly said that she wishes that the ballot was available in more languages. The Voter Rights Act states that states and political subdivisions, so like Cuyahoga County or Franklin County or wherever, must provide language assistance or translated documents if more than 5% of that population speaks a certain language. So if 5% of Cuyahoga County's population spoke Mandarin, the federal law states that they would need to have that ballot in that language. Now, no parts of Ohio actually meet those requirements, although many parts of the state do offer in Spanish. But voters can bring interpreters to the polls. But currently, there's not a huge effort to make that change. But certainly, Susan expressed that she wishes that that change would be made.
Coming to U.S., they have a right to vote. I think they're very proud, and they do want to participate and exercise this right. And having materials in their language help them understand the process will help them access this right.
You started to say what the state does require. Are there requirements that we have imposed upon jurisdictions, whether it be Cuyahoga County or some other place, on what we have to provide for non-English speaking people? I mean, like we said, we just provide a Spanish ballot right now.
At this moment in time, nothing's different.
Nothing.
Yeah. So there are these organizations that make these efforts to bridge that gap. Mike West in Cuyahoga County went out of his way to do this ballot review, and Susan from the Cleveland Chinese Senior Citizen Association was it helped translate. But there's numerous organizations that are looking to help out, and Susan was just one of them.
Mm-hmm. There are other things you have in the pipeline. You've not just been looking at this. I know that you've been examining all kinds of things in the election era.
Yes. Yeah, so we spoke. I want to get to one more gentleman that
sure.
to earlier, if we could. I spoke because one of the organizations is CAMEO, the Cleveland American Middle East Organization. It's another nonpartisan political organization. And one of their services is they help direct non-English speaking voters to translation help. And I spoke with a gentleman named George Kusa. He's actually a CAMEO board member, although he works as a translator. So he's one of the people that can help. He hasn't had any voters come to him for ballot translation mm-hmm. yet, but he's hoping that he does. He's fluent in Arabic, but he says that like Susan said, many foreign-born American citizens aren't able to participate in the election. So when they come here, this is part of that American dream, and they want to be able to participate.
Right, and we've heard that so many times with people becoming naturalized American citizens, the first thing they do is register to vote. Okay, we were talking about what's coming up in the future. For people who weren't with us, you did a piece in Medina County a week or so
right.
ago, letting folks around here know what they're thinking. You're going to go to another county now.
Right. So I went to Medina County, and basically the idea was let's get the pulse of voters. Let's talk to some voters who have some Biden signs in their front yard, some Trump signs in their front yard. Let's talk to the heads of the county parties. And I'm going to do the same thing in Lake County next
okay.
week. So I'll have some updates from Lake County. And one thing that I'm looking forward to that'll be different than Medina is when I went to Medina, this was before any of the debates happened. So we knew that the debates were coming up. So it was fun to talk to the voters about what do you expect Donald Trump to say? What do you expect Joe Biden to say? And obviously we saw what happened in that first debate. It wasn't
not what we expected.
Well, maybe it was what some of us expected, right? But, after hearing the first debate and, soon to be the second debate, now we can get to voters who maybe have been swayed one way or maybe they've heard something that they haven't heard before. So I'm excited to see what's going to happen in Lake County.
Specifically Eastlake, Painesville, where you had?
I'm going to start in Mentor. But if anybody okay. wants to email us or give us a call, I'm happy to come find you.
IdeaStream Multiple Media producer Gabe Kramer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let me go back to Justin. You're still there, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good. We wanted to talk also about things that you have coming up in the pipeline, and let's go back to the Woodhill Homes residence. I know you're working on a special project there.
I have been, yes. I've been buried in tape, Rick, and editing lots of stuff that I've gathered over the last year. And all of the three people that we heard from today by phone about the election, we're going to be talking to them in much more depth and hearing really personal stories for them about life at Woodhill Homes and in public housing as part of a podcast and a series that'll air on SOI, Sound of Ideas, that you and I will be hosting together.
Right.
You knew that, right?
I knew that, yeah. Okay. Can't surprise me with everything,
yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, yeah. So okay. Anyway, so yeah, folks will have a chance to hear a lot more from all the people we featured today.
Awesome. Justin Glanville, thank you so much for your contributions this morning. Much appreciated.
Sure, thank you.
Okay. After the break, we're going to talk about another important event happening coming up Saturday. It's Drug Take Back Day, and you can help save lives. You're listening to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Rick Jackson. We'll be right back.
"2020 has been unpredictable, to say the least, and that's what makes the continued support of our members so special. The up-to-date, trustworthy news you've come to rely on is possible thanks to listeners like you. If you're able, please consider donating at ideastream.org/donate and help keep local journalism alive in Northeast Ohio. Thank you, and remember, we're here for you and because of you."
It is human nature to crave connections, to want to know what's happening in the news and with each other in our communities. Wherever you are, whatever is happening, tune into this public radio station or ask your smart speaker to play NPR to stay connected at home.
And choose WCPN as your station.
You're back with The Sound of Ideas from 90.3. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Rick Jackson. Though the coronavirus pandemic remains top of mind this year, another health crisis rages on in the shadows. That's the opioid epidemic. Just yesterday, a major pharmaceutical company, Purdue Pharma, which manufactures the painkiller OxyContin, agreed to plead guilty to criminal charges for its role in the crisis. The company will face an $8 billion penalty. $8 billion. The company's owners will pay another $225 million in civil penalties. It's unlikely, though, the company will end up paying $8 billion because they're currently in bankruptcy court, so this is all far from finished. There are more lawsuits that could be coming down the pike to address the public health crisis that's resulted in more than 450,000 deaths in this country since 1999. But despite the attention and the intervention, Ohio's on track to have one of its deadliest years of opioid drug overdoses. So the need to combat opioid addiction remains. This Saturday, the Cleveland Clinic participating in a national event called Drug Take Back Day, where staffers will be collecting communities' unused medications to dispose of them properly. With us to discuss Drug Take Back Day and why you shouldn't leave unused medication lying around the house in general is Dr. Ellen Rome. She's head of the Opioid Education and Prevention Committee for the Cleveland Clinic and head of the Center for the Adolescent Medicine at Cleveland Clinic Children's Hospital. Thanks for joining us, Doctor.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Much appreciated. And tell us first off about Drug Take Back Day. We should mention that while this is a national event Saturday, actually here in Cleveland, you can turn in unused drugs at the clinic at 14 locations year-round.
Yes. So National Drug Take Back Day helps raise national awareness that this is a thing. In Cleveland and at the Cleveland Clinic, we would love National Take Back Day to be every day. Because really, you can give back those drugs and clean out your cabinets of all pills 365 days a year, 7 days a week, not just at our 14 sites, several of which are at our main campus and many of which are in our surrounding family health centers, but also the Solon Police Station, other places where you can easily go back and give in your drugs. So there's many, many places.
Is this a new push nationally for everybody to try and do what the clinic does every day, but for people to participate around the nation?
Yes. And the reason is pills lying around are a pathway for addiction for many people. And so, for instance, teens will have pharma parties and clean out the bathroom supplies, throw them in a on the table or in a bowl and play button, button, who gets the button. Adults. I've had many patients tell me that they had used two pills after a surgical procedure, but then had 20 still left in the bottle. And 6 months later or a year later, when they were feeling a little bit of pain or distraction or other things, took them and ended up with a pathway towards addiction. We would rather prevent that in the first place, do primary prevention, not have them have the drugs in the house in the first place unnecessarily, and secondary prevention of getting them the heck out of there so that we don't need the tertiary prevention, which means as many patients affected and or dying. And we know that there's been over 400,000 deaths related to opioids since they hit the market. And we had a record high
drug overdoses due to opioids in 2019, and 2020 is on track to do the same.
You touched on a couple of things there I wanted to follow up on. First off, that the idea of young people who first began using because of the availability in the parents' medicine cabinets, I always thought some of that was urban legend, but you say there's a lot of truth to that? That's how people start?
Absolutely truth. It happens in nice suburbs even more often than in our urban homes. So this is a thing. It's a problem. And the pandemic has many people housebound and looking for a new thrill. So it's a particular risk now.
I hadn't even thought about that aspect of it. I was going to ask you later how the pandemic impacted the opioid crisis. Other than that, has there been an impact because of COVID?
We're seeing, well, yes. And for instance, if you get addicted to opioids, the next cheaper thing is heroin or fentanyl or carfentanil. And when people haven't been using in a while and suddenly use again, whatever the opioid or prescription or heroin or illicit drug, they tend to use what they last used. And the same amounts can then be a cause of overdose because the body is no longer tolerant of mm-hmm. that dosing.
You touched on some of the numbers. I wanted to give people a little bit more specifics there. In 2018, Cleveland Clinic pharmacies collected 1,014 pounds of unused medication. That doubled in 2019 to 2,700 pounds plus. And already this year, in 6 months, you've collected almost 1,700 pounds. So we're on a path to exceed even the record numbers. As someone who sees the results of all this, you've got to be terrified.
Yes, and it's something where we can make it simple and accessible. You don't have to go to one of our family health centers to find a disposable kiosk for your drugs. You can also just take a good old-fashioned plastic sealable bag and then used coffee grounds or kitty litter. The kitty litter doesn't have to be used. And empty your pills from their containers right into the bag, seal it, and throw it away in your own garbage. So clean out day, 365 days a year, can be just safely within your own home.
For you were talking about the kitty litter or the coffee or whatever. What's the issue? Why are you trying to keep the pills from being useful so people don't try and lift them out of your trash?
Yes, that's part. And also so that they don't get into the landfill or the water system and cause downstream problems, literally.
How much medicine would it take in a landfill before we start seeing it leach out?
That's a great question and a super question for some of our environmental experts. Thanks for asking that.
Okay, well, that's something we can both look up in the future. Let's get back to talking about this idea of bringing the drugs to the clinic. Where should they take it? Does it matter how they bring it in? I don't suppose you want kitty litter.
If they want to do it in the kitty litter, that's fine. But that can go in their own bathroom. Even if they're in their own pill bottle, that's okay. We'd prefer them to black out their name and address, because that's another form of potential crime in the future. If you're giving out your private information. But so our sites range from Beechwood Family Health Center, our Cleveland Clinic sites of Children's Hospital's pharmacy, the Cryo Pharmacy, and our Euclid Avenue Pharmacy, Hillcrest Hospital right in the Atrium Pharmacy, our Independence Family Health Center and Lutheran Hospital, Marymount Hospital, Medina Hospital, Richard E. Jacobs Family Health Center, Stephanie Tubbs Jones, our Tausig Outpatient Pharmacy at Main Campus, Twinsburg Family Health Center, and Union Hospital all have these black kiosks that are brightly marked that say in blue poster form, safely dispose of your medicines right here. So those are visible in all those sites, but also you could go into a local police department or other sites and similar bins are available. There's also, for those who don't want to do it themselves with their own sealable bag, there's bags you can buy online that you could, such as doTERRA or Element MDS Ready Packs and Pill Terminator Safe Pill Disposal Containers that can also allow you to dispose of your medicines in your own garbage as well. So they're welcome to walk through our doors. We love to see people and know that they're doing the right thing. It's also user-friendly to do it just right from your own home and properly dispose and put them in your own garbage. Either way makes National Drug Take-Back Day a daily event.
We're talking with Dr. Ellen Rome about National Drug Take-Back Day. She's the head of the Opioid Education and Prevention Committee for the Cleveland Clinic and head of the Center for Adolescent Medicine at Cleveland Clinic Children's Hospital.
we were kind of wondering earlier here, if you're taking drugs back and they aren't legal, can you be arrested for taking them back, or is there some kind of immunity because you're turning them in?
There's some, to my knowledge, from talking to our local police and lawyers, there is some immunity for that. We would rather people save lives and save their own life than risk that harm. So, yes, if it's illicit drugs, we are quite happy to have people go to the police and give those back. And again, you can always say, I found these from a friend, if you're really, really worried about it. But that would be a perfect site to get rid of those.
Okay. The other thing I wanted to follow up on from your opening statement there was availability. And I've seen this happen in my own family. Somebody had surgery, needed one opioid pill, but the prescription was for 30. And they called me saying, what do I do with these other 29? Why is it that doctors prescribe so much more than what a patient may need? And is that a big part of the problem as you see it?
It so is. And in fact, at the Cleveland Clinic, we've had some major pushes to address directly that. So part of our opioid education and prevention efforts has been involving our OB patients, for instance. And now at Fairview and Hillcrest, we've gone from that similar dilemma of sent home after C-section with a bunch of opioids to in hospital, making sure women are getting around-the-clock Tylenol appropriately. And then assessing them, have they even needed an opioid? And if they didn't need an opioid their whole admission, we're not even sending them home with any. And the women are happier, the babies are happier, and this has been a really wonderful effort and has decreased our opioid prescriptions exponentially. Just by putting a laser focus on doctors' prescribing practices, we've also, for other surgical procedures, been able to decrease the amounts that are given. And this is true in Cleveland and in Akron, where when you train residents and fellows and attendings to write for less, write for what they'll need, and then educate on the risks of opioid addiction with close follow-up, post-op, both by phone and then in person, you can actually do harm reduction and primary and secondary prevention right then and there. So we would like this to be a national push where doctors are prescribing less, but also covering what is needed, helping transition from opioid to other longer-term pain management strategies, and educate the public to look when they're given a prescription and say, huh, am I really going to need 30? How about 5 and I'll be able, you know, or 10 and be able to reach you as this coming week if I need more.
It makes a lot of sense. You talked about the education aspect. The doctors and the nurses know what this is, but somebody who's lying in a hospital bed at Hillcrest or Marymount or Summa Health, for that matter, don't realize how quickly this could turn to an addiction.
Yes, that's so true. And that's where partnering with patients and families to make this education more broadly known, and radio shows such as this one to make sure that
the
public is aware are so very important.
Okay. Wonderful information. Good luck with Drug Take Back Day on Saturday. We've been speaking with Dr. Ellen Rome, head of the Opioid Education Prevention Committee for the Cleveland Clinic. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you so much.
Much appreciated. We're going to take a short break, and after we get back, another story coming up. Stay with us.
IdeaStream's Listen, Engage, Vote 2020 is your resource for informed decision-making at the polls. Follow our national and local election coverage at ideastream.org/vote2020.
You're back with The Sound of Ideas from 90.3. I'm Rick Jackson. The foiled plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer and President Trump's controversial comments during the debate here in Cleveland when he directed the Proud Boys to stand back and stand by. They're an FBI-designated extremist group. All put a renewed focus on extremist and white nationalist groups operating in the USA. FBI Director Christopher Wray told lawmakers last month the bulk of the Bureau's work on domestic terror threats originated with racially motivated extremism cases, many of those of white supremacists. Last week, we spoke to the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League, based here in Cleveland, about the landscape of hate groups in today's climate. But only some listeners heard that great conversation. It was preempted on air by the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Judge Amy Coney Barrett. Now that we're back on, let's play it now.
Joining me now by telephone to talk about the landscape of hate groups and extremism here in Ohio and the Midwest, James Pasch. He's the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League based here in Cleveland. The region it serves includes Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Western Pennsylvania. James, good morning and welcome.
Great to be with you, Mr. Jackson. Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. We are not taking phone calls today, but the email is still open, soi@wcpn.org, if you have a question for James Pasch. Extremist groups once seemed to be consigned to some dark corner of the internet, James, or some other shadowy place. Is it fair to say they've grown bolder now, almost mainstream, certainly more visible?
Hate groups are certainly more visible in Ohio and across the nation. And what we're seeing here pretty much mirrors what we're seeing across the Midwest. And you know, this past year, we could track over 30 different hate groups across the state of Ohio. And, you know, right now, I think our largest concern is what we're seeing is an uptick in threats due to a perceived urgency of extremists who see the upcoming election as almost a flashpoint. And while it's not cause for panic, it is certainly a cause for great concern.
You say 30 groups. Give me some play as to what's a normal number. What we were seeing in 2016? What did we see in 2010?
Yeah. So when we talk about normal numbers, it's really the growth of the groups that we're talking about. So, you know, in the intro, you talked about the Proud Boys, and the Ohio Proud Boys have witnessed a 300% growth for their chapters in Ohio since 2019 alone. So the statewide mobilization of extremist groups is something we really have to keep an eye out on. And we also in Ohio have a proliferation of what we call local area code militias. An example is the 330 militia group of Northeast Ohio, who, you know, when you look at these groups and the exponential growth of them, and you couple that with that they're
groups neither forcefully nor quickly enough. Do you think a forceful denouncement from the administration would even help at this point?
I think a forceful forcefully coming out and speaking out against white supremacists, white supremacy, extremist groups in all of its forms is helpful from every office in the land, from the president all the way on down. It needs to are less than helpful.
We talk about this extremist plot to kidnap Governor Whitmer. Its planning roots were in Ohio. Actually, five of the suspects are in court today. Are there similar terror groups operating in the state that you're already aware of that would have that kind of a plan?
Yeah, you know, when we talk about the deplorable plan to overthrow the Michigan government and to potentially kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, I think it's important to understand that although the incident occurred in Michigan, it could have occurred in many places as well, like Ohio. And anti-government extremists, such as the growth of white militia, growth of organizations like the 3%er organization that have been particularly active in 2020 here in Ohio. And you see them taking advantage of right-wing sentiment that surrounds state gun control measures, state lockdown measures, and the pandemic prevention efforts. And they've gained steam around those moments and in those movements.
With some of these groups, we hear the phrase alt-light being tossed around. What does that mean exactly? And is that any less of a threat because it's light? Or define for me.
No, I think when we talk, you know, what is the difference between alt-light and alt-right, I think it's important to note what the most important thing is that as we see groups, whether there are groups like the Three Percenters that I just talked about, or the Proud Boys, or other smaller militia groups, I think what we need to concentrate on is that there are ways to stop its growth. And it starts with our elected leaders at state levels, at local levels, to meaningfully integrate the threat. By like I said, bipartisan statements condemning it. We also offer extremism training for elected officials and for law enforcement. And we need to review our state terrorism laws, our voter suppression laws, and we cannot allow unlawful militias to masquerade as protesters.
The whole idea of using that word you just used, militia, when some people want to call them domestic terrorists, are we getting caught up in the minutia of all of this when we should just focus on the end result?
A little bit, yeah. I think, you know, the end result is certainly important, right? The most important thing, which is, you know, we see the trend lines, we see the growth, and we know it needs to be stopped. And, you know, if it doesn't, if we do nothing about it and we allow it to go unchecked, that's how we wind up in a dangerous situation. Like I said in the beginning, right, we're not at a place where there's cause for panic, but there is cause for concern. Rather than, you know, debate the semantics of a specific label, I think we need to understand the threat that's in front of us and deal with it accordingly.
You threw a stat at me a couple of minutes ago. I think a lot of people probably sat up when you said Proud Boys in Ohio have grown 300% since 2019. Let's look bigger. Hate groups are consistently rising in the region. We saw what happened at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh about 2 years ago. That's a part of this region. What's driving that increase in action? What's driving that increase in membership?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple things. And, you know, we had 2 chapters, you know, with the Proud Boys. We now have 6 chapters of the Proud Boys in Ohio. But, you know, one of the, when we talk about the growth of hate groups or the growth of hate, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about the growth of online extremism, right? Because these days, the largest area of growth are people who are unaffiliated, right? People who are not necessarily acting within an organized group where they are a member, because the internet has allowed people to kind of skip that membership step and to form an ideological bent by people that they meet online. And, you know, we have seen, you know, when we look at the dark corners of the web, the growth is certainly there.
We talk about the synagogue shooting a couple of years ago, July 21st, 25th, and 26th here. We had that spate of anti-Semitic vandalism in University Heights, a suburb with a sizable Jewish population. Shocked lots of people in Northeast Ohio. I wonder how concerned you are about the state of anti-Semitism in Northeast Ohio.
Extraordinarily concerned. We are seeing levels of growth and incidents being reported to our office that, quite frankly, we haven't witnessed in this area since we started tracking anti-Semitic incidents, and so which is over 60 years ago. That incident in University Heights hits really close to home for me. I live right around the corner. This is my community. This is my home. And it was an attack on all of us. And so, right, we have to be cognizant that the rise of anti-Semitism throughout Ohio, and particularly here in Northeast Ohio, is real. It's not perceived, and we see it every day. And, you know, we talk at the ADL about something called the pyramid of hate. And so when we talk about hate symbols and hate speech, it's important to know that if we don't stop it in its tracks and we don't stop it where it is, then it grows into violence. Mm-hmm. And so it's crucial that we do something about it before it gets worse.
James, it's my neighborhood too. I drive Green Road many times a week. Were you surprised and pleased to see the neighborhood, though, issuing its statements of support, coming out and helping to clean, coming out and telling the Jewish population, we are with you?
I was. And, you know, on issues large and issues that are, you know, quote, smaller, one of the things that is a common thread is that whenever there is an incident of hate, whether it's in our community or in a surrounding community, the community's response to those incidents is what provides us hope. It shows us the true character of who we are, and it shows us that whether it's in University Heights or whether it's in Pittsburgh, that hate will have no place here or anywhere in this country, because there are a lot more people who are going to stand with us than they're ever going to stand against us.
Mm-hmm. Let me shift gears a little bit since you're here. Recent survey by the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany revealed that 2/3 of young adults, we're talking 39 and younger, have little information about the Holocaust. In some parts of the U.S., mm-hmm. 6 in 10 people can't name one of the 1,000 World War II concentration camps. Do you think that lack of knowledge, spread of misinformation, is contributing to this rise in anti-Semitism that we see?
Yes, Mr. Jackson. As we all know, right, education is power. And if we don't know our own history, then we're in trouble. And so I certainly support recent efforts going on in the Ohio State House to increase Holocaust education in the state of Ohio. I think Holocaust education should be mandated in every state across the United States. And it's not. It's only, you know, mandated in a handful. And so, you know, that's a real area of concern. And as we come up to a time where there are fewer Holocaust survivors amongst us, it is our solemn obligation to ensure that their stories and their lives and the events of the Holocaust are not just not forgotten, but that they are continually learned about and listened to and read, and that's going to be the only way. You know, education is the most important weapon we have to fight hate.
We will leave it there. My thanks to James Pasch, the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League. Thank you so much for taking time today.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson.
Appreciate it. The Anti-Defamation League's based here in Ohio includes oversight of Kentucky, West Virginia, and Western Pennsylvania. If you'd like to get the last word on today's topics, you can do so. Call us at 216-916-6397. Send an email, soi@wcpn.org. Coming up tomorrow in the Sound of Ideas, the weekly Reporters Roundtable with Mike McIntyre, including the next installment of our Idea Stream and StoryCorps combined series One Small Step, which we ran short on time for yesterday. If you missed any portion of this program, hear it again on demand, online, or by downloading the podcast. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you on Monday.